Welcome to the March 17th edition of the Worldview Future for 2024. Today, our focus is on training peacemakers, or maybe we could call them.
WORT would like to thank the following local restaurants and businesses who provided meals for our hardworking volunteers during our recent winter pledge drive. Bandung, Bonzo, Cardinal Bar, Cooper's Tavern, Einstein's Coffee and Bagels, Glass Nickel Pizza West, Hong Kong Cafe, Ian's Pizza on State Street and Francis Street, Just Veggies, Lao Lang Zong, Migrants Madison, Melio's on MLK, Original Pancake House on University Ave, Pizza Bruta, Soups I Did It Again in Spring Green, Teddy Wedgers, Weary Traveler Free House, Wilma's Fund LGBT Assistance, and the Willie Street Co-op. WORT would like to extend our gratitude to these restaurants for helping to put the community in WORT Community Radio through their donations of food. Gratefully yours for nearly five decades, this is WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Welcome to Worldview, your weekly source for news and analysis from around the world, right here on community-supported radio, WORT 89.9 FM.
Good evening, and welcome to the Sunday, March 17th edition of Worldview. I'm Lee Rowe, and I'm your host. Before we begin, Susan, who keeps us up to date on fundraising affairs, has let us know that if you haven't donated to this amazing radio station during our two-week fundraising drive, and you still want to, all of the donation information, including pictures and info about our very cool thank you gifts, will be on the WORT website through tomorrow. That's at WORTFM.org. Susan also said that we didn't quite hit our fundraising goal, but that we now have a $5,500 matching grant. So your pledge today or tomorrow will be doubled. So don't call us because there are no phone answers here. But go to www.WORTFM.org. and click on the orange donate button and do the community thing. And later in the program, Gil Halstead will talk with Dr. Stephanie Knox, an assistant professor at the United Nations University for Peace in San Jose, Costa Rica. Yes, it's a real university. And we will find out about its history and programs. But first, we have the news.
A major internet outage affected West and Central Africa on Thursday, with operators of multiple subsea cables reporting failures. Main One, owned by data center operator Equinix, said that an external incident resulted in a cut to its cable system in the Atlantic Ocean offshore Côte d'Ivoire along the coast of West Africa. They ruled out human activity as a cause. The company said that its preliminary analysis suggests that some form of seismic activity on the seabed resulted in a break to the cable, since it was some distance from the land and at a depth of almost 2 miles at the point of the fault. The company said it has a maintenance agreement with the Atlantic Cable Maintenance and Repair Agreement to provide repair services for the submarine cable, and that a complete restoration could take up to 5 weeks, although it could take less time. In the meantime, Main One said that it had arrangements with other cable companies, and it would work tirelessly to restore as much of the network as possible. Business and banking were the major victims of the loss of internet connections, but given the importance of IT services to all sectors of society, everyone with an internet connection was potentially affected.
Usman Sonko, the charismatic anti-establishment politician and one-time Senegalese presidential candidate who's won over Senegalese youth by promising to fight corruption, was released from jail on Thursday. He'd been there since July, serving a 2-year sentence for corrupting youth, and was barred from running for president due to a separate case involving defamation charges. His supporters claim he was locked up to keep him from competing in Senegal's upcoming presidential elections. Sonko has now urged his supporters to vote for his aide, Bassirou Diomaye Faye, with the message, "Ousmane is Diomaye." What is now Faye's program includes the renegotiation of the country's mining and energy contracts. He also wants a review of the relations with former colonial power France, which is an issue across Africa at the moment. And one of his more popular programs is to tackle youth unemployment. 3 out of 10 Senegalese between the ages of 18 and 35 are jobless. Elections are to be held in a week on March 24th.
The Election Commission of India, its independent poll conducting body, yesterday announced the dates for India's election. Rajiv Kumar, chief election commissioner, said that voting will run in 7 phases from April 19th to June 1st, and vote counting will take place on June 4th. An estimated 969 million voters are eligible to cast their ballots to elect 543 politicians to the Lok Sabha, the lower house of parliament. N. Bhaskara Rao, the chairman of New Delhi's Center for Media Studies, expects spending by political parties and candidates to woo voters to cost more than $14.4 billion, approximately the same amount spent on U.S. presidential and congressional races in 2020. When the schedule is announced, a model code of conduct also begins and campaign rules apply, and Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government is not allowed to announce new policies that could influence voters. The principal protagonists of the 2024 battle are Prime Minister Modi and his BJP party, who lead a coalition of more than 36 parties, and the main opposition, Congress party-led alliance of about 24 parties.
A Hong Kong court sentenced 12 people to jail terms from more than 4 years to nearly 7 years yesterday in a high-profile case linked to the storming of the city legislature during a pro-democracy protest in 2019. Storming the legislature in 2019 was in response to the government's refusal to withdraw an extradition bill after 1 million people marched against it. The bill would have allowed authorities to send people to mainland China for trial. The people sentenced were high-profile actors, political activists, and student leaders. Political activist Owen Chow told the court before sentencing, quote, "No matter what punishment the court imposes on me, I'll continue to move forward and convert my fear into a force for change, just like the day I walked into the chamber," unquote. He said their actions stemmed from a need to stand up for basic human rights that were under threat from authorities. According to police figures, more than 10,200 people were arrested in relation to the protests in 2019, of whom 2,937 have so far been charged with offenses including rioting, unlawful assembly, and criminal damage.
Last week, a U.S. court convicted former right-wing Honduran president Juan Orlando Hernandez of narco-trafficking. For 3 weeks, Hernandez's lawyers tried to persuade jurors that the state's witnesses of convicted drug traffickers and murderers were liars and their testimony was untrustworthy. The former president also maintained his innocence throughout the trial and could be sentenced to life in prison. Hernandez was a staunch U.S. ally in its war on drugs, portraying himself as a law and order candidate in his 2013 campaign. Just days after his conviction, his wife and former First Lady, Ana Garcia de Hernandez, announced she would be seeking a nomination for the presidency next year. She said many within the National Party, her husband's party, have expressed their support for her bid, and that she has received many messages of support from Hondurans across the country. She said in a press conference that this was about showing the world the injustices committed toward her husband.
Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry confirmed last week that he would step down after the creation of a transitional presidential council. His announcement comes after days of silence for Henry, who was stranded in Puerto Rico following his trip to Kenya. Caribbean Community Chairman Dr. Mohamed Irfan Ali said, quote, "The transition arrangement paves the way for a peaceful transition of power, continuity of governance, near-term security, and free and fair elections," unquote. During a televised conference, Ali also said, quote, "We implore all parties, all stakeholders, all Haitians for a chance for this agreement to work. This process requires patience. Let us give a bit. Let us sacrifice a bit. Let us give this agreement a chance to work," unquote. All reports from the conference indicate that there has, to date, been no agreement. And there is yet to be a response from the gangs who have taken control of Haiti, especially influential gang leader Jimmy Barbecue Chirazier, who warned of a civil war and genocide unless Henri stepped down. As security and food has become increasingly difficult to find in the midst of Haiti's worst humanitarian crisis in years, aid is only able to trickle in. The main international airport and land crossings are closed, presenting impossible challenges for those who want to help. The BBC reports that hunger is worsening as hundreds of thousands are facing famine-like conditions unless there is a massive and coordinated response soon.
Clashes continued in southern Lebanon between Lebanese Hezbollah fighters and Palestinian factions on one hand, and the Israeli occupation forces on the other, as Hezbollah announced that they will continue to target Israeli military sites near the southern Lebanese border. The official Lebanese news agency reported that Israeli occupation forces bombardment is covering all of southern Lebanon, not just border communities, and the confrontations have to date killed 242 members of Hezbollah, 11 from the Amal movement, 12 from Islamic Jihad, and 13 from Islamic Resistance Movement. That's Hamas. Additionally, 48 Lebanese civilians, an army soldier, and a member of the internal security forces were also killed. 6 Israeli civilians and 11 soldiers were killed. In Jordan, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz arrived in Aqaba in southern Jordan yesterday to meet today with King Abdullah II of Jordan to discuss regional unrest due to the war in Gaza. Scholz's visit will also include Israel.
A senior European Commission official said that the European Union will provide some $8 billion in financing to Egypt from 2024 to 2027 under an agreement to expand the scope of cooperation that was announced in Cairo today. The financing includes financial aid, investments, and grants, with $1 billion to be dispersed this year. The agreement aims to enhance cooperation in areas including renewable energy, trade, and security, while providing grants to support the faltering Egyptian economy. European governments have long been concerned about the risk of instability in Egypt, a country of 106 million people, where economic hardship has prompted mass exodus in recent years. Inflation is near record highs, but is easing slightly as Egypt has just concluded a record deal of Emirati investments and will borrow more from the International Monetary Fund. And those are our headlines for today. Now here's Gil with our first longer story.
Since it seized power last July, the military junta in Niger, like the military rulers in neighboring Mali and Burkina Faso, have kicked out French and other European forces and turned to Russia to support. But it has retained a $110 million U.S. manned base that has been vital for monitoring extremist groups connected to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. Until yesterday, following a visit by U.S. Ambassador Assistant Secretary of State Mali Fi, the State Department's top official for African Affairs, and General Michael E. Langley, who heads U.S. military operations in Africa, the junta had a message for the Americans. Amadou Abdramani, the junta's spokesman, in a statement read on television, and the Nigerian government denounced, quote, with force the condescending attitude, unquote, of the head of the recent U.S. delegation, which he said had undermined the long relationship between the two countries. The government, he said, was, quote, denouncing with immediate effect, unquote, the accord between Niger and the U.S. military, along with civilians working for the Defense Department. He said, quote, the American presence on Niger's territory is illegal and violates all constitutional and democratic rules, unquote. There were about 1,100 troops in Niger as of last year. Adramani said Niger was not aware of the number of U.S. civilian and military personnel on its soil or the amount of equipment destroyed, and according to the agreement, the U.S. military had no obligation to respond to any request for help against militants. U.S. State Department spokesman Matthew Miller said yesterday that U.S. officials are, quote-unquote, aware of the statement and that it had followed frank discussions last week. He said the U.S. delegation conveyed U.S. concerns about the ruling junta's trajectory. Miller said that U.S. officials are in touch with the junta and will provide further updates as warranted. In his televised statement, Abdramani emphasized that Niger's relations with Russia, along with those with Iran, stretch back decades, and criticized the United States for trying, quote, to deny the sovereign people of Niger the right to choose their partners and the type of partnership able to help it truly fight terrorism, unquote. That seemed a not-so-subtle hint that Niger intends to follow Malian and Burkinabe military regimes in attempting to fight their ongoing terrorism problems in cooperation with Russia and or Iran.
In the Sudanese battle between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid support forces, both forces have shown disregard for the lives of Sudanese civilians by waging war in densely populated urban areas. The scale of destruction is unprecedented in Sudan's modern history. While world attention has been focused on Gaza and Ukraine, this bloody war has received little high-level political, parliamentary, or international media attention. Sudan is suffering from a humanitarian disaster. It is the world's biggest displacement crisis. 8 million people are newly displaced inside or outside the country, in addition to over 3 million displaced by previous conflicts. The head of the World Food Program has warned that the war risks creating the world's largest hunger crisis, yet the UN's humanitarian response plan for Sudan is only 4% funded. UNICEF says that nearly 730,000 Sudanese children are thought to suffer from severe malnutrition, including more than 240,000 in the remote region of Darfur. The RSF has looted humanitarian warehouses and besieged cities. The Sudanese army-controlled humanitarian aid commission has systematically withheld authorization for movement of life-saving aid to RSF-controlled areas. And regional actors are fighting proxy wars in the country, giving military, financial, and political support to the warring parties. The involvement of Russia and Iran has given the war a geopolitical dimension linked to Putin's war in Ukraine, partly funded with Sudanese gold and competition for influence on the Red Sea coast. The UN has accused the UAE of landing plane loads of drones and armaments in northern Chad for use by the RSF. Egypt has been involved, as has South Sudan and Uganda. In fact, all neighboring countries have had a hand or a word with one side or the other, and sometimes both. The UN Secretary General, the UN Security Council, the African Union, and the League of Arab States joined forces to call for a Ramadan truce, a significant increase in pressure on the warring parties. But Ramadan has begun with more fierce fighting. There had been no diplomatic engagement to agree to an implementation and monitoring mechanism for a truce. Not that it mattered. Neither of the warring parties have paid much attention to negotiated and agreed to truces.
Mexico City is approaching day zero, where the government will no longer be able to provide them with water. The city, which was built on water, is now nearly dried up. Residents of many surrounding Mexico City neighborhoods are now forced to get up at dawn to receive water rations from delivery trucks. Last week, over 300 residents from the village of San Lorenzo Huipulco in the borough of Tlalpan blocked the avenue leading north into central Mexico City to protest the lack of water, entangling commuter traffic. One specific area, known as Valle de Bravo, has been reduced to a shrinking and increasingly polluted patch of mud flats and water due to a combination of drought, bad planning, water transfers to the capital, and lawlessness. Valle de Bravo had been known as the Hamptons of Mexico in the past, when it was a popular haven for wealthier families. Now residents there say it's being drained due to Mexico City's refusal to fix the pipes. The development of luxury compounds and private lakes have also prevented large amounts of water from reaching the Valle de Bravo reservoir. The lack of water is also being exacerbated by high temperatures and thieves tapping the pipelines. Criminals take tens of thousands of liters of water that they sell illegally each day. Mexico City's water agency, Sacramex, which oversees water distribution in the capital in conjunction with borough governments, has received nearly 1,400 reports of illegal tapping operations. However, only 153 were confirmed and closed down by officials. There's a larger problem with Lake Cuitzeo, one of the country's largest freshwater lakes, which has repeatedly lost 70% of its water over the past 2.5 decades. The nearby city of Pátzcuaro also saw large and unusual protests against its year-long water shortage. Residents of several neighborhoods washed their clothes in a water fountain in the Plaza Vasco de Quiroga to draw attention to that crisis. According to the most recent data from the country's National Meteorological Service, 75% of Mexico is in drought.
The Yemeni Houthi fighters, known locally as Ansarullah, or God supporters, launched 3 anti-ship ballistic missiles toward the Red Sea without causing injuries or damage, according to the U.S. Central Command. The Houthi group reported that a rare meeting was held last week in Lebanon with leaders of Palestinian factions, most notably the Islamic Resistance Movement, Hamas, to discuss mechanisms for coordinating resistance actions against the Israeli occupation forces' aggression. The coordination started at the beginning of Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, the name that Hamas gave the attacks on southern Israel on October 7th that led to the Israeli attacks on Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The Houthis said last Thursday that the scope of attacks on ships linked to Israel will be expanded to include ships that avoid crossing the Red Sea near Yemen and try to sail in the Indian Ocean toward the alternative route around Cape Hope on the southern tip of Africa. In an attempt to deter the Houthis and protect maritime navigation, since January 12th, American and British forces have launched strikes on sites belonging to the Houthis in Yemen. Following these strikes, the Houthis began targeting American and British ships, considering that the interests of these two countries had become legitimate targets. Iran supports what is known as the Axis of Resistance, which includes Palestinian factions, including Hamas and Islamic Jihad, Lebanese Hezbollah, and Iraqi factions, in addition to the Yemeni Houthis. In early January, the United States and Iran held secret meetings in Oman to discuss the Houthi attacks in the Red Sea, Iranian-affiliated militias in the region, and the ceasefire in Gaza. The U.S. demanded that Iran use its influence to pressure the Houthis to halt the attacks, but Iran required a ceasefire in Gaza as a condition.
An Israeli delegation is scheduled to arrive in the Qatari capital, Doha, tomorrow for negotiations of a prisoner exchange slash ceasefire deal between the Israeli occupation and the Islamic resistance movement, Hamas. World Central Kitchen, the charitable foundation, said yesterday that it is preparing the second relief ship in the port of Larnaca, Cyprus, to be sent to the Gaza Strip. Their first ship carrying food and necessary supplies arrived last week. Work continues to establish a U.S.-built jetty in an area under the control of Israeli forces southwest of Gaza. The Israeli war on the Gaza Strip is in its 163rd day. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry yesterday, 31,553 people have been killed and 73,546 injured, most of them women and children. The Israeli bombing has continued throughout the Gaza Strip today, and the Palestinian Ministry of Health said that the Israeli occupation army committed 7 massacres within 24 hours, killing 63 and wounding 112 people. Israel's refusal to enact a ceasefire, indifference to the high number of civilian victims, and the extent of the destruction the war has caused was described by the International Court of Justice as quote-unquote genocide. The United Nations reports that the situation in the Gaza Strip has become catastrophic and is deteriorating every minute as a result of the siege imposed by Israel, especially in the northern regions, which are on the verge of famine. Meanwhile, 6 trucks of aid arrived in the northern Gaza Strip, the first in 4 months. The ongoing Israeli occupation in the West Bank killed a Palestinian youth in an armed clash in the city of Hebron. As of Friday, 435 Palestinians have been killed, 4,700 others injured, while the Israeli occupation forces have arrested over 7,600 Palestinians. Continued demonstrations against the current Israeli government headed by Benjamin Netanyahu and the most right-wing coalition in its history have demanded a negotiated prisoner exchange with the Palestinians. According to Israeli Occupation Army data, 591 Israelis have died, including 250 since the start of the operation on October 27th.
And that's a wrap of the news from around the world for Sunday, March 17th, 2024. I'm Lee Rowe.
And I'm Gil Halstead.
Sources we used to prepare today's stories were All Africa, Al Arabiya, Al Jazeera, Anadolu, the Associated Press, the BBC, Chatham House, Deutsche Welle, Election Commission of India, France 24, The Guardian, Haitian Times, IRNA, Mexico News Daily, The Middle East Eye, The Middle East Monitor, Nigeria's Premium Times, Reuters, Sana, UNICEF, UN News, and The Washington Post.
Welcome to the March 17th edition of the Worldview Future for 2024. Today, our focus is on training peacemakers, or maybe we could call them peace workers. My guest is Stephanie Knox. She's the assistant professor and academic coordinator of the Peace Education Program at the United Nations Mandated University for Peace in San Jose, Costa Rica. We spoke on Zoom yesterday, and I'm welcoming her right now. Stephanie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Gil. It's an honor to be here.
So I want to ask you first about what is the University for Peace? What does it mean to be a university mandated by the United Nations? So tell me a little bit about the history of this university that you work with and for down in Costa Rica.
Sure. So the University for Peace was founded by the United Nations in 1980. So we've existed for about 44 years now, and we are an institute of higher education. We operate at the graduate level, so we offer master's degrees and doctoral degrees, as well as certificates and professional development programs as well. And the university's mission, and I should have pulled the mission up to read it to you. I don't have it in front of me right now, but it's basically to serve humanity and as an institution for higher learning around peace, peace learning, peace knowledge, peace education, and the values of the United Nations.
In the midst of all the wars going on all over the planet right now, what can a student with a degree from your university do to help build peace with the training that you're offering there?
Yeah, well, I would say to start, and maybe this is not the right thing to say as the professor at a university, but please don't wait to get a degree to work for peace. I do believe that studying peace, and I believe that peace can be learned. And that's why I'm in the field of peace education, because I believe that if we want to see a more peaceful world, then we need all educational spaces that can teach for that and teach in that direction. However, I don't want people to think that they need to wait until they have a master's degree to go work for peace either. And sorry, are you hearing the background noise right now?
No, it sounds sounds fine. Great. No, this is really good. No,
my dog is barking, so I wasn't sure how annoying.
No, that's okay.
But yeah, I mean, in terms of what students who come to our programs do, so we offer a number of different master's degree programs. I teach in the Peace and Conflict Studies department, and within our department, we have master's degrees focused in peace education, gender, international peace studies, and media and peace studies. And then there's also a department of international law and human rights and a department of environment, development, and peace. So that kind of gives you the scope of our work, which is highly interdisciplinary. I would say that students across all programs, there are some shared courses, and students have some understanding of all of those areas of operation, looking at peace in a very holistic sense. But in terms of what students do after graduation, it varies wildly. Because we're UN affiliated, there's probably about a quarter to a third of our students head in the direction of working with one of the UN agencies. A number of students take advantage of that affiliation. But I wouldn't say it's the majority exactly, though, either. A lot of students go back to their home countries, which is also to say we have students from around the world who come and study here at UP and do community work or work for their own government, their home country's government. Students go on to found organizations. There are many paths, because ultimately we need folks who are trained in peace working in just about every career path, every vocation imaginable, in my humble opinion.
Well, let me focus in on one of those that's of interest to me, and I hope also to our listeners, about international law. We're hearing so much now about what is going on in terms of how to use international law and the International Court of Justice in dealing with wars that are going on now, the ones raging, in particular, we think about what's happening in Gaza, that's at the top of the news, but in Ukraine and in other parts of the world as well. So, because you did mention that there are students who get involved in the international law, the legal side of things. Can you say a little bit about that?
It's actually hard for me to speak to that because I'm not...
It's not your department.
Yeah, I apologize. I would defer that question to my law faculty, who, if you would like to have them on at some point, I'm sure they would be most happy to join. But yeah, I can't say too much more about that.
Okay, so you're working in the peace and conflict studies area of the coursework that goes on there. Tell me about that.
Sure. So our students, well, and all peace students come and they take a foundations course, which is an overview of peace studies, and it also is an introduction to conflict analysis. So in that course, they do a lot of conflict analysis work using a few different kinds of models. Then they take a course on the UN system. So all students in the university also take a course that talks about how the UN system works or sometimes doesn't work as well as we would like it to. And so they have a grounding in that. Then they move into departmental and specialization courses. So for example, I teach the intro to peace education course. Most of the students coming into peace education want to work within the broad field of education. So that means formal systems, that means community training, more along the lines of popular education in its broadest scope as well. Students also take a few practical courses around tools for conflict transformation. They have a course called Peace Lab, which gives them communication, facilitation, and dialogue training as well. So we've tried to design the program so that they have a strong theoretical foundation in the field of peace and conflict studies, but they're also developing practical skills that they also, you know, can use on campus when they're learning together as well.
So the graduates might, with the master's degree that they can get from the university there in Costa Rica, they might go back to their home countries and actually teach in the public education or private education sector in teaching other students. So in some sense, you may be teaching teachers. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It does. And we do. Yeah. Sometimes folks, I had a student last year who was a lifelong teacher in the LA Unified School District who came here basically for a sabbatical and just wanting to refresh her own teaching. And then she returned to LA Unified and took the new perspectives, the new tools and things that she learned through the peace education program back to her work in her school. We have some folks who are switching careers. I think that's pretty common with a master's. You know, sometimes people have gone out and done some kind of work, but they want to head in a different direction or deepen into a direction. So sometimes folks are coming in with no teaching experience, and which is fine. We have space for all of that. And there's one of my favorite things about teaching there is the collaborative learning environment that we try to create, and creating a space where students can really learn from each other and their experiences. And that includes the experiences of their lives and the places that they're coming from, as well as their professional backgrounds.
Well, speaking of the places they're coming from, because you talked about people going back to their home countries, the example you just gave was someone coming back to the United States. But what's the demographic globally or internationally in terms of the student body there? How many different countries or people or students coming from?
You know, I don't know the statistics of this year offhand, but usually it's something around 50 different countries represented. Students come from Central and South America, North America, Europe, Africa, Asia. We used to have a very strong scholarship program that brought a large number of students from Asia. The program unfortunately ended this academic year. Last year was our our last iteration with that group of students, but we're hoping and always looking for opportunities to create more scholarship programs like that that are more along the lines of a fellowship, because that's to me what we really need. I mean, this education needs to be widely accessible, and I think for UPEACE as an institution, it really thrives the most when we have a very diverse student body with students from around the world.
And so, speaking of the student body and where they're coming from, what is I know what I'm thinking of here. So why in Costa Rica? Why did this end up being, and this is getting back a little bit more into the history of the institution you work for. How come it started in and still exists in Costa Rica?
Yeah, the then Costa Rican government of the late 70s and early 80s requested that it be established here. It was really their guidance and their wanting it to be here, that the university was established here. So the government at that time, I believe it was under the government of then-President Rodrigo Carazo, and they led that initiative at the UN and were able to have it established here. And one of the reasons that it, I think, was appealing as well for the UN itself to have it here is that Costa Rica doesn't have an army. And so it's one of the examples of a country in the world that does not have an armed forces.
And so pursuing that line a little bit more in terms of the funding for the organization, as you described it, the government of Costa Rica initiated this and got the program started more than 40 years ago now. Is there funding from the United Nations? You were talking earlier about scholarships available, but how does the funding system work there? Is there some funds that are coming from the United Nations, and which means
we're not UN funded, for better or for worse? I mean, I think the strength in that is that we're more independent, more autonomous, and it gives us a lot of freedom to be critical in general, but of the UN additionally. And yeah, it means that we don't have UN funding. So funding comes from tuition, donations. These often, what has worked in the past, are scholarship programs that are usually provided by a foundation or a member state who wants to contribute. So UN member states sometimes contribute to the university, but the UN as a whole does not.
So it's not, but it's described in its title as being mandated by the UN. So
yeah, I know it is a little bit confusing. So how I usually describe it is it's UN founded, but not funded.
Oh, that's a good distinction. Yes.
It has this affiliation and it has a strong relationship. Like, we have a representative in Geneva. We report to the UN Council, the UN General Assembly, rather. And so there's definitely a relationship there. And we very much were born from the United Nations. But yeah, we're not funded, which gives us some academic freedom and autonomy, I believe.
You're listening to the Worldview Future for March 17th, 2024. I'm Gil Halstead, your host, and we're talking with Stephanie Knox, who is an assistant professor and academic coordinator of the Peace Education Program at the United Nations Mandated University for Peace in San Jose, Costa Rica. So I wanted to shift actually a little bit back to you, Stephanie, and your connection with the university. I mean, tell us a little bit about how you ended up there and what it is that, I guess, keeps you at this job at the University for Peace in San Jose, Costa Rica.
Sure. So I ended up here initially as a student. Long story short, I went through school, did an undergraduate degree, went into the Peace Corps after that. Sometime after the Peace Corps, I was teaching English in Japan, and I loved teaching. I found out through that job that I really, really loved teaching. But at the time, I was trying to weave themes like human rights and intercultural understanding and sustainability and things like that into my English as a second language lessons. But as I was doing that, I was like, this is what I would really love to be teaching. And so I started looking into graduate programs, and I was looking specifically at Peace Corps fellowships because there's a Peace Corps fellowship program for return volunteers. And I had found a program and was planning to apply for it. And then I thought, well, I should look around more at what else is out there. And it was through a Google search, which I feel like that's how a lot of people end up initially finding us. They find us looking for peace studies online. And I came across the University for Peace. And when I saw they had the peace education program, my heart just lit up. I was like, this is what I want. But then it seemed so, it almost seemed unreal. I was like, does this place actually exist? And luckily, I knew someone who knew someone who had gone here, and I was able to meet with them and confirm that, in fact, it does exist. There is a whole university dedicated to peace, and it is in Costa Rica, and it's beautiful. So that was how I ended up here in 2009, 2010 as a student. After I graduated, I worked, well, while I was doing my master's thesis writing, I was interning for an organization called Teachers Without Borders, and they were looking for volunteers to help develop a teacher professional development program about peace education. So it was a really great opportunity for me to apply what I was learning in the program. And then afterwards, they hired me on as staff. And I returned to the U.S. and was working for Teachers Without Borders. And after that, I did some work for the Meta Center for Nonviolence, which is based in the North Bay area in California. Both of those jobs, I was working remotely, though. And then I was doing some teaching in Southern California at a few different colleges in the realm of peace studies. And as I was teaching college, I was, again, just wanting to be teaching more. And the idea of doing a PhD was on my mind. And so eventually, I found a program that was a good fit at Pacifica Graduate Institute, the Community Liberation, Indigenous, and Eco-Psychology Specialization, which is many words, but for me, it's peace studies and peace education by other names. And I finished my doctorate in 2022, and that was when this job came up. So it felt very full circle that academic jobs don't open frequently, and that I was able to, at that moment, come back to UP as faculty. So this is my second academic year as faculty, and I'm really happy to be back and in this role.
So let me ask you, we talked earlier about a lot of people who, it sounds like a lot of people who come out of this program who end up finding it and applying and getting admission to get a master's there may end up teaching. I mean, that's what lots of people who get master's end up doing mm-hmm. at universities in different places around the world. You are teaching in the Peace and Conflict Studies department, I guess. Is that what it's called there at mm-hmm. the University of Peace?
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about the curriculum there that students who come there would be studying when they're taking the Peace and Conflict Studies part of the degree.
Yeah, so some of this I touched on a little bit. So they take this Foundations in Conflict
Analysis. Right, right. And what is that? What is the foundation in Peace and Conflict?
Yeah, well, the Foundations course is taught by a professor whose name's Dr. Amr Abdullah. He currently resides in the U.S. at Juniata College, but he's been involved with UPeace for many years, I think since 2002. And he teaches the Foundation course, which is using this... They use several different conflict analysis models, but the model that he uses... The acronym is CR CPABIO. It's been a while since I took the course, so I cannot tell you the outcome of that acronym.
Well, I should ask you about the course teaching then.
Sorry, Dr. Amr. and Yeah, so they start there with conflict analysis, like how do we understand, what are the tools we can use to understand conflict? How can we use these tools to analyze conflict at local levels, at international levels? I mean, for me, within the peace education program, we're always holding the personal and the interpersonal and the global together. And so really thinking about peace in a holistic way, and the small ways we can build peace in our lives, from like the daily practices that help nurture our own peace to our communication skills with the people that we're interacting with in our lives, to these bigger changes that need to happen relating to the structures, the institutions, cultural violence at much larger levels. So in the program as a whole, we're trying to hold that at all times. Yeah.
And so I guess I want to return a little bit more to, because on the Worldview program, we are often talking with people who are directly involved in war and peace situations in different parts of the world, or, well, in conflict situations, which is what the work that you're doing in terms of training people is, preparing them either to teach about this to others or perhaps to become professionals who are actually addressing it and trying to help resolve conflicts. So within the program that you're teaching, in terms of when it comes down to the practical level, are you really, for the most part, talking more about training people to teach at the level of students who may be in elementary, secondary, or college, to be able to deal with complex situations on an international level?
So I'm teaching people to teach peace, which to me, education is an absolutely necessary part of peace building and building a more peaceful world. But it is also often a longer term solution. And we need folks who are doing more. I mean, we need folks working from all different angles, in my opinion. So I was sharing the example of those students who are in the International Peace Studies program, for example, right now are taking a course on peacekeeping, international peacekeeping and humanitarian operations. So I would say, you know, there's a lot of students from UPeace and particularly that master's program who go more in that direction of direct peacekeeping and humanitarian work internationally.
Okay. And so I want to return, as we're getting close to wrapping it up here, to how students can apply to and get accepted to and come down to Costa Rica to actually participate in the program. And are there ways to do it virtually, since so much of education is going on that way?
There is, and I will mention, so let's see, to start, so we have the in-person on-campus program, which is what I'm resident faculty in. I recommend the experience immensely. It's a very unique experience, and Costa Rica is a wonderful place to come spend a year. So for that, the program applications are due at the end of May. May 31st is the admissions deadline. Because we're a graduate institution, students need to have completed their bachelor's work. And then along with their transcripts and things like that, they write a statement of purpose. So that's basically, you apply on the website and then we get in touch with you from there. In terms of virtual opportunities, we're in the midst of change right now, because basically when the pandemic started, everything went totally onto Zoom for a while, of course, when things were shut down. And then it came back in this hybrid situation where there were students in person and students online at the same time, synchronously. And we found that while that was a quick fix to the problem, addressing the issues of the pandemic, it's not optimal pedagogy for online learning. So we're in the process of change, but I will say that there's the online master's and then there's a totally online master's in sustainable peace that students can apply to as well. their certificate programs if folks want to take shorter, like maybe they already have a master's or they don't want to do a whole master's program, but they would like to study peace education, for example. So we have certificate programs for that. And then we also have a center called the Center for Executive Education that specializes in more along the lines of professional development. They also do study abroad programs. So yeah, there's a lot of different ways to get connected with us. I would direct folks to the website, which is just upeace.org, and they can see the variety of ways they can learn and visit with us there. And I wholeheartedly welcome all of your listeners to come study with us, come learn with us. We'd love to have you.
Well, Stephanie Knox, it's been really a pleasure talking with you, and we hope perhaps we can have you back on Worldview, or perhaps talk to one of your students about their experience there as a way to just illustrate more what's going on with the University for Peace in Costa Rica. So we'll look forward to contacting you about that in the future. I think that's something that we here at Worldview would be interested in promoting. I mean, we're here in, you know, a huge university context at the University of Wisconsin here in Madison with thousands of students, many of them looking at master's degree possibilities. And so it might be something that we could help promote or, yeah, just inform the student body here about.
That would be amazing. Thank you so much, Gil. Really appreciate you having me. It's been a great pleasure to talk with you today.
Thank you, Stephanie.
And that's Worldview for this week. Thank you to Dr. Stephanie Knox for joining us and telling us about the University for Peace. You can find more information and application forms at www.upeace.org. That's the letter U and then peace.org. And please don't forget, you can still donate to the WORT Winter Fundraiser and get fabulous thank you gifts by going to WORTFM.org and clicking on the donate button. And thank you. And thanks to the Worldview Collective, especially to Gil Halstead and Buya Jeme, Sabiatia, Maria Brunetta, and to WORT News and Public Affairs Director, Shali Pittman. And thank you for listening, and please join us next week for a new edition of Worldview here on your community-sponsored radio, WORT 89.9 FM Madison and WORTFM.org. And now, stay tuned for Salamat.
Are you passionate about community music and local voices? I'm Jay Davis, and I'm thrilled to share an exciting opportunity with you.
I'm Tom Davis, a proud member of the programming committee at WORT. We're the heartbeat of Madison, shaping the airwaves with diverse, engaging, and community-driven content. But to keep the beats flowing, we need your help.
Since you're listening to WORT right now, you may be aware of this, but this is more than just a radio station. It's a platform for local expression, a hub for artists, and a stage for community voices. Join our programming committee and become a driving force behind what goes on our airwaves.
Whether you're into music, news, culture, or something entirely unique, we want your voice in the mix.
Visit our website at wortfm.org/programming-committee, or you can email me directly with j.davis@wortfm.org, and we can start the conversation.
WORT, where your voice matters.
In Arabic, we say, "Iju li haddul khail, mad al far, ijro."
Translation: they came to put a horseshoe on the horse, and the mouse extended his leg.
This one has a double meaning. One being those who stick their noses or insert themselves into matters that are far above their stature. You know, they have nothing to say in the matter, but they still insist on getting involved in things that are way above them, not just the pay grade. Mm-hmm. But it also refers to the lowly person, you know, lower.